Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. I am really excited for this one, and I say this a lot, I really do. But this one I genuinely am, because we're doing history, but we're going at it from a completely different angle. And with me, I've got obviously my wonderful Christopher, and Christopher is going to tell us who have we got on. Chris, who have we got on?
When you said you're excited, I was hoping it's because I was here, but you know, I'm always here. But someone who isn't always here is we have Paul McNeil, who is a writer and presenter and genealogist, and he's here today to talk to us about genealogy. So, Paul, welcome to History Hack.
Thanks for having me on. Looking forward to it.
We were talking about this before we started. Genealogy, you had an anecdote for genealogy. It's really popular, isn't it? How popular is it?
It's the second most searched for term after porn on the internet.
And Chris's joke followed as?
And that's just my search history.
Well, this is it. So genealogy, everyone's getting into it. Everyone, even random people in my Polish groups are trying to get people to help them with genealogy. I mean, Polish history is really difficult, obviously, but everyone's like, oh, I need to know where my great, 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 great grandfather came from. Okay, so let's do it. I mean, first of all, your story on getting into it is just as entertaining, actually, isn't it, as some of the conversations we're going to be having. So tell us, how did you get into genealogy and why?
So I didn't really get into it on purpose. It was accidental. And I suppose it goes back to, you know, I was born in, we can tell by my voice, I was born in Peckham in London, and from a very working class background, never had any money or anything. We had an outside loo and, you know, lived in a slum in the back streets of Peckham, just off the Old Kent Road. And I always used to wonder, why are we poor? Why haven't we got any money? You know, I'd know other kids that had a nice house and a nice garden and this sort of thing. Is it just me dad's a bit useless, or, you know, is there more to it? And that sort of stayed in the back of my mind for years. Anyway, years and years and years went by, and eventually I left school with no qualifications but a good education, and went to grammar school. So I didn't do any work, because at the age of about 16, I discovered drinking and girls and motorbikes. And but I managed to get a job in the Greater London Council. And I got into the computer department, because you had to do an aptitude test. I thought, well, that's good. You don't need the qualifications, but you do need to take an aptitude test. So I took this test and I passed it. And they had a kind of a class structure there that said, right, if you can get through the aptitude test, so you're obviously bright, if you've got a degree, then you're one of us and you can be a programmer. If you haven't got a degree, then you're probably not one of us and you can be a computer operator. So that's what they made me. So I became a computer operator at the Great London Council back in the 70s, when computers, you know, filled rooms and it had the same computing power as, you know, your watch has got nowadays. But we kept London running. You know, we paid all the wages. We did all the stuff for the fire brigade, all the architects department. So everything went through the big mainframe computers they had there. And that was fine. And that was great. And I didn't care that I wasn't a programmer, because we used to do loads of overtime. And we actually earned more than them. So it was a fantastic job for a working class kid with no qualifications. So we'd do shift work. So you'd work a day shift, work an evening shift, work a night shift. And on the night shift, you get really tired, you know, and you try and keep awake by having half of the shift on shift, operating all the machines, making sure everything's running. And the other half would go to the tea room and, you know, have something to eat, play cards, gamble, all this kind of stuff. And then one day we found out that there's a gym in the basement of the GLC building. So the Greater London Council building at the time is now the Premier Inn on the South Bank. So it's a big hotel there now, but it was the head of the GLC was based in there. So we found this gym down in the basement. So in the middle of a night shift, we go down to the gym and we'd have a workout for an hour and have a shower, go back upstairs. And, you know, you're 4 o'clock in the morning, you're bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, you got on with your work. And the other lot, the other half went off of shift and they went down there and did whatever. So this went on for a while. And then one day we went down there and we used to get bored. We were young working-class blokes that were reasonably intelligent. You know, we passed the aptitude test. And, you know, you'd be spending long hours in the darkness at night, you know, getting bored, just keeping London running. So we found all these different offices down in the basement next door to the gym. And one of them had London Metropolitan Archives written on it. We thought, well, that's interesting. I wonder what's in there. So everything was locked. But us being South London blokes with an unusual skill set, we gained access.
Can I just say, I love the way you said that. That is so clever, so nice. Saying, "Oh, we just like totally broke in."
Well, you said that. I didn't say that, and there are no witnesses, and I would deny it in court. But nothing was broken, and nothing was nicked. But we gained access to the London Metropolitan Archives at like 4 a.m. So we go in there, and we think, "Oh, what's all this then?" And we just have a look around, because we were just bored more than anything. And it was all the parish records, all in the big folders and everything. So we're looking around, and I went up to the area where I knew my family came from in Peckham. I started pulling some of the, you know, birth, marriage, death records out. And all of a sudden I had like an epiphany. And I was pulling out these old books going back, you know, early 1800s and beyond. And my family came tumbling out of these books. And it was like you've opened a Dickens novel and the characters are coming out, but they're your family. And I was finding births, marriages, deaths that were all McNeils from, you know, from where I came from. And I was related to them. And I was hooked from that minute. I was completely hooked on the idea of finding out more about them. I just thought, well, this is how I got here. This is why we didn't have two apneys to rub together when I'm growing up. This is why I'm an operator and not a programmer, because, you know, it's your background. It's everything that kind of made you. So that's what really kicked it off with me and got me into it. And from that, it was a matter of saying, OK, so where do we go from here? How do I find this stuff out? So, you know, I started buying the magazines because you couldn't look it up online because there wasn't any online in the 70s. So I found out you had to go to Somerset House, you had to go to different places, you know, London Metropolitan Archives, but I could get in there at night, so that wasn't a problem. Never had to queue for any parish records or anything. And just started tracing my own tree. And that was the starting of all of it, really. That's what really set it off. But the problem I've always had is because, you know, I come from a working-class background, I've never been able to do anything without wanting to make money at it. Because otherwise it's like, well, just go and play football or something. If you're doing something like this, then you've got to find, there's got to be an angle. You've got to find a way of making some money out of this. And it sort of played on my mind for a while. And I thought, well, if I can trace my family tree, I can probably trace anybody's because I'm nobody. You know, no one famous in my family tree. So maybe I should be looking at doing something with this. And years later, I left the GLC. I started doing, you know, other jobs. I ended up running the European arm of a software company, started by five of us, and built it up to a multinational company, flogged it to the Yanks, took a load of money and kind of semi-retired. But I was living in Winchester by then. I'd moved out of Peckham, down in Winchester, and we had a big house we'd built and kind of extended. And a bloke called Terry Jacobs came round to paint the window frames. And I was just chatting to him, lovely bloke, and had his own little business, lives in Eastleigh. And got chatting to him, and it turned out that his birthday, not the year, but the date, was the same as one of my sons. I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I knew his name, knew his birth date. So while he was painting our windows over like a 2-week period, I start looking him up and looking his ancestors up. And in that 2 weeks, I got his family back 200 years. And they were just like shepherds, you know, in the Eastleigh and Mansbridge area near Southampton. And I'd be sitting there, I'd find something else about him, and I'd knock on the window and say, hey, Terry, come in and have a look at this. So come in, and I'd show him. I'd say, look at that, that's your great-great-great-grandfather there. He's going, oh, wonderful. Then, of course, my wife was there, so she'd come in and say, let him paint the windows, leave him alone, let him get on with his job. And I got told off for tracing his tree. But I thought, right, if I can do mine and I can do his, then basically I can do anyone's. So I just started setting up tracing people's trees, you know, for a small amount of money just to see if anyone would be interested. And I started getting a lot of interest in it. And I thought, well, how do you make some real money out of this? I thought, well, you've got to go to something that people want to see more than the individual. So basically, I used to listen to Danny Baker when he was on the radio, you know, a South London boy like myself. And I thought, well, this could be interesting. So I traced his tree and I got them all the way back to like the early 1800s in Windsor. They worked at Windsor Castle. They looked after the beer cellars for the royal family. And there's all sorts of interesting stories in his tree. And I just sent it in to him on the radio to see what had happened. And he read it out and gave me a plug on the radio. I thought, well, that's good. So then I went from there and thought, well, what's better than radio? Telly. So what I did, there's a trick to it. You find people that are well-known and have got an unusual name. So I looked up a bloke called Fred Dynage. And I know not everybody will know who Fred Dynage was, but he used to do it. He used to read the news on Meridian TV in the south of England. And he used to do a program called How. And it was a children's program where they would teach you all about science. Do you remember that?
Carol Vorderman as well.
That's right. Yeah, that's where they started.
Yeah, I used to watch it.
Dynage is a really unusual name, really unusual. You know, there's like less than probably 50 people in the UK that's got that surname. So I thought, right, I looked that up. That should be easy to trace. And basically, I traced it all the way back, and I found he had an ancestor on the Titanic, went down on the Titanic, and he had another ancestor that was in the Rifle Brigade at the Battle of Waterloo, fought at the Battle of Waterloo, and stayed on during the occupation of France afterwards. Met a French girl, married her, and she changed their name from Dunnage to Dynage. She put an E in the middle of it. And so I thought, well, this is interesting. I was in business by then. I was selling stuff. I was doing a lot of sales. So I thought, right, I'm going to cold call them. So I just called up Meridian TV and said, right, I'm local. Got this wonderful story about Fred Dynage and with an ancestor on the Titanic. Are you interested in it? And they were like, oh, yeah, you know, that sounds quite good. So they send him down with a film crew. So my missus is out doing some shopping. I'm indoors. I've got a Rolls Royce parked on the driveway with Fred Dynage on it with the number plate HAL1 and a film crew in there. And we make a little program, not exactly a program, but an outtake, you know, that they put on after the news, a feature about his ancestors. And we took him all the way back to, you know, the Battle of Waterloo and the Titanic and all this kind of thing. And I thought, well, that's good. That's easy enough. So once they know you, they know you. And they think, all right, you're all right in front of the camera, so we'll see what else you can do. And then I did like one for the weatherman, one for someone from another channel that used to read the news. And I did a few of those. And that's really how it started. It wasn't how I got into DNA Journey, but it was how I got, you know, to see how you get into these things. Some of it's luck, some of it's just pushing yourself forward. So my journey in this was unconventional. It was I think calling it a burglary would be going too far. It was an unconventional entry to the London Metropolitan Archives, followed by just trying to make money out of it. So that's my story, how I got into it.
My granddad was a policeman in Brixton, so the words unconventional entry in London, well, you know what that means.
You just have to use the skills that you've got, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. So I started my research sitting in my lunch break in the IWM library. So,
but well, it was very, very similar. So you probably did yours in daylight hours.
Yeah, yeah, because I didn't work nights, but otherwise I'd have been up there if I did nights. But so how emotionally invested are people in this when they get involved? Because it's not just sort of a passing interest for people, is it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the first time I realised just how much it meant, because what you do, you start off and you get a load of dates and you get a load of names and you get places. So you build a tree and, you know, there's your grandfather and your great-great-grandfather and your cousins and your fourth cousins once removed and all this kind of thing. And it's kind of meaningless, but it's a lot of names and it lets you know, are you from that area? Are you from somewhere else? Did they all die young? You know, did a lot of children in the family die? So you start to get little emotional hints to it. But then one day I was in a records office and I was going through the records for a workhouse, because again, all my family were poor. None of them had any money. And mainly the reason for that was, A, they fought in the wars as private soldiers, which is always a bad thing to do if you can avoid it. And the other was they all died of TB. So swathes of them died young of TB. You know, and if you're in a working class family and the breadwinner dies early, then you're knackered and, you know, you're going to be poor. And that was our family story over nearly 200 years. So I'm in this records office, and I've got the records out for the workhouse. I opened it up and my great-great-grandmother was in there. And, you know, it's interesting. I thought, great, I found her. And I started reading it. And what the guy that had admitted her to the workhouse had put was, you know, Elizabeth Nugent, that was her name, no friends, no family. And I'm not kidding. I mean, I'm a proper bloke, right? You know, I'm from South London. I'm not a spring chicken. And I was in this records office and I burst into tears. And I couldn't believe it. And I thought, well, this is someone that died 150 years before I was born. I never knew him. Why am I so upset by someone that I never knew? You know, it could just be a story in a book, but it's not. And it's a personal link. And you start to see all the things that happen through history to put you where you are today. And if just one of those things had been different, you won't be here. And it just brings things home to you. And the worst of it was that woman did have a family. So her children were alive, but none of them had enough money to take her in. So she had to go to the workhouse and plead to be taken in. And the only way to do it was to say, I've got no friends, I've got no family. And it was quite heartrending at the time. I mean, you know, talk about it now, you sort of rationalize it over time. But yeah, it's very, very touching. And not only that, I mean, I do the TV show, you know, DNA Journey, ITVX, for anyone that's interested, fantastic show. And we do celebrities. And I always try and put them on the back foot a little bit, because you want people giving you genuine reactions rather than a manufactured reaction or rather than doing their skit, you know, especially if they're a comedian or something. You want them to be them rather than the character. And we come up with some stories that really reduce people to tears. It's quite amazing. And having been through it myself, I can kind of understand it. You get inured to it over time. I've done so many trees for so many people now that it's very rare that something will touch me. Occasionally it does, usually something about children or something like that. But generally you just accept it because there's nothing you can do about it. And it's the way life was. But when you see it for the first time, and it's your family and it's how you got here, it really can have a quite shocking effect on people.
So I find this really, really interesting, because I've my uncle's really been into it, and he keeps finding really random things. And he's like, did you know that this happened in the family? I'm like, no, not really. Because we've managed to trace our family back to about the 1500s. I can also trace my father's side all the way to the 1500s. And that's only because, well, that side of the family never moved from Białka Trzęska in the Polish mountains. It's never gone anywhere. But out of interest, what is the longest family tree you've done? Because I know for a fact we could probably find further in the distance somewhere somehow. But for you, how far can you actually go with this?
There are kind of two answers to that. The first one is, if you're an average person and your ancestors didn't own land, and we're talking about mainly about the UK, but it applies to most nationalities. if your ancestors didn't have money or own land or were a merchant or something like that, then you're probably not going to get much further than 1500s if you're lucky. You know, 1600s, 1700s, most people can get back to. But much before the 1600s, 1500s, you'll be really lucky. If you're a peasant, you're just not going to find anyone because the records are gone. You know, they've rotted. They've been thrown out. They've been bombed. God knows what's happened to them. And most people didn't do enough to get mentioned anywhere outside of church records. However, if you can find a key into the aristocracy or a landowner, all of a sudden it becomes different. Because you start to get into legal documents, you make wills. I mean, 99% of people never made a will because they had bugger all. It's like, who am I going to give my shoe with a hole in it to, as opposed to who am I going to give the cottages to or the, you know, the castle or whatever. So you start to get into wills where people are named and they're specifically named as my son, my grandson, my aunt, my whatever, you know. So all of a sudden you're getting pieces of genealogy just handed to you. The best of all is if you can get someone who's an aristocrat, even if they're a minor aristocracy, because even if you can't find, you know, parish records, which you may not be able to do, you'll probably find church records and similar for marriages, etc. And it's all about who owns what. Because nowadays, if you want to find out who owns what, you've got the records, and worst case, you probably go to court about it. In the Middle Ages, if there was a dispute over who owned what, someone got killed. So you wanted to make sure it was very clear who owned the land, who it went to in terms of sons, daughters, whatever, marriages, dowries. And all of a sudden you get all these church records because most of the people couldn't read and write other than clerics, etc. So they would keep records outside of normal birth, marriages and deaths. And they would keep like Bede, you know, they would keep diaries, if you like, that would tell you of great things that happened to great men and great women. Wouldn't tell you much about the ordinary person. But once you get into that, although you have to treat it with a piece of salt, you know, a pinch of salt, and it's not like finding a birth certificate and then finding someone in a census and finding three different things that prove it's them. But you can start to get back a long, long way. And the furthest I got back was for a guy. I did his family tree, and he commissioned me to do another tree for his wife. And it was an interesting family called the Trowbridge family. And they had a link into minor aristocracy in Somerset. And as soon as I got into that, you could get back to the French royal family. They were from a family that came over with William the Conqueror, basically, like all the British aristocracy descended from. And once you get into that, you can get back to Charlemagne. And once you get back to Charlemagne, you can get back to the Frankish kings, earls, dukes, war leaders beyond him. And actually, a number of those married into the old Romano-Gallic aristocracy that was still there. So what you got the Romans, you know, what do they ever do for us? You got the Romans who've got land and they've got some influence, and you've got all these barbarian tribes coming in who can kill you if they feel like it. So the barbarians wanted to be Romans, basically. So they would want to marry into the landed gentry of the, you know, the Roman provincial aristocracy. And the Roman aristocracy would want their sons and daughters to marry a hairy barbarian so that no one was going to come and steal anything from them. And the records were kept by bishops and monks and nuns and people like this, because a lot of them were related anyway. So on this one particular family, technically, I got back to about 400 AD. But you got to remember, this is not finding a birth certificate. This is not finding a census. This is someone saying, well, you know, this earl's third daughter was, you know, Godwina, and she married Leofric, and, you know, and it's all this kind of thing. So you're taking it as read that what they wrote was correct. So it's tentative, but it is showing you something. So that's how far I've got back, to about 400. And I explained to him, it went back like, I don't know, 20-odd generations. It might have been a bit more than that. And you could trace it all the way back if you accepted what the chronicles said about members of these families. The hard bit is often when you get to the early Middle Ages in England, for example, trying to find out who was legitimate, who wasn't, and, you know, did this guy marry that guy, or did his son marry the miller's daughter, and things like that. But once you get into a royal line, you're away. You can go back, you know, literally back to the Romans, but you're not going to get three separate sources that would all confirm that it's definitely right. But it's going by the chronicles, etc. And that was fascinating, especially the causes of death. So my family, causes of death, cancer, TB, a bit of cholera, probably shot in the war, this kind of thing. You get into a royal line, and you get back to the early medieval times, and you get things like torn to shreds by an angry mob in Alexandria. You get, this is this guy who was one of the ancestors of this family. He was sent by a Frankish king to take a princess to Byzantium, you know, Eastern Roman Empire, Constantinople, Istanbul, to be married off. So he escorted her there. For some reason, coming back, he went via Alexandria. And when they land on the dockside at Alexandria, one of his retainers killed one of the local porters who had got in their way or done something, you know. So he just pulled his sword out, killed him. They went off to stay in an inn for the night. The next day they've come out, they're going to get back on the ship. And an angry mob from Alexandria surrounded them and tore him to pieces. So that was his death. And like a monk somewhere recorded this in Alexandria, and it got back to the Frankish court and they recorded it. And that's how I picked up on it. There's another one where a guy, he was showing off how much money he'd had. He just murdered his father. This is the aristocracy for you. And he was trying to impress, again, Eastern Roman vassals that had come to see him. And he was trying to show him how rich he was. And they were out to kill him. He didn't know this, so he showed them all his gold. And they said, well, you've got so much gold there, I bet you couldn't possibly pick that up if you put your arms in it. So he sunk his arms into all this gold. And while he has his arms in the gold, they pulled their swords out, finished him off. So my lot get TB and, you know, a bit of bronchitis. You get into the royal lines and you get some wonderful causes of death.
Oh, I'd love it. Oh, some good ones.
So you can get back a long way, or most people will get back to the 1700s in a UK-based family tree. You know, some will get back a lot further. It depends how well connected the people were before you. Of course, if we get into DNA, it's another story.
Yeah, people keep trying to tempt me with the DNA search things, but how does that actually work?
So loads of companies now will trace your DNA. I mean, I tend to use Ancestry, not just because I work for them occasionally, but because they've got a very big database of people that have put their DNA in, and they've got a nice front end on their webpage. But I say that there are lots and lots of companies that will test your DNA. And what they're doing, they're looking for patterns in the DNA. So what, you know, your genes, your alleles, you know, what haplogroup you're related to, and this kind of thing. So they'll break all that down for you. You send them in a sample of spit. So you send that in, they test it, they break it all down, and they'll send you charts back saying, right, this is the patterns of your DNA. They'll put that in their database, and then they'll compare that to all the other people that have, you know, paid to have their DNA tested. And what it looks for is patterns that match other people's patterns. And there are millions and millions and millions of them, but they'll look for strings of them. And the more similar your DNA is to someone else's, the closer you are related to them. So, you know, we're all descended from an ancestral Eve from, I don't know, 300,000 years ago or whatever in Africa. So 80,000 years ago, all Homo sapiens were black people, and all of us lived in Africa. And then from that time, different tribes started moving out of Africa, and, you know, skin became lighter, eyes changed, hair changed, et cetera, et cetera. So you got all the, you know, the mass diaspora of people from Africa. And as we moved, different things happened, different sets of genes got passed on, some didn't get passed on. And so you've got these unique signatures. So the nearer you are in terms of the patterns in your genes to someone else, the closer you're likely to be related to them. So they compare them to, you know, thousands and thousands of other people, and they'll come back with a list. And if you've got your, if you've done a tree and you've got that on the website, then you can compare it to other people's tree. And if the results of the DNA say, well, this person is probably your, you know, your cousin, then you look at their tree, look at your tree, and you can match them up. And you can link the trees and you say, okay, right, now I see how we're related. So then you go back, they may have discovered people in their tree that you don't have. So you can then start making links between them. So it's a mixture of DNA and it's a mixture of documentation, basically, and some of it's even word of mouth, to build your tree and to bring the DNA into it. So that's on a surface level, and that's what most people tend to use it for. So that most genealogists would use it like that. It's to look for relationships and look for other people you may be tied to. But there's other things you can do with it. So most DNA, and let me explain how this works. So when a mummy and daddy are very much in love, they have a special cuddle, and the daddy's DNA and the mummy's DNA get mixed together to make a baby. The thing is, it's only half of their DNA. So each sperm has half of the father's DNA in it, and each egg has half of the mother's DNA. And the other half is non-existent. It may be in another sperm, it may be in another egg, but it's not in that particular one. So in every generation, everyone that's born has half of their ancestral DNA missing. 50% from the mother, 50% from the father. So that gets combined and it tells you a bit about, you know, who you are. So you won't be exactly the same as your brother or your sister, unless you're identical twins, then you may well be the same. But apart from that, no two people are ever the same, because half of the DNA is lost in every generation, except for two pieces of DNA, the Y chromosome, and the Y chromosome is what makes you a man. So only men have this, and it only goes from father to son, obviously. So that goes all the way back to your original male ancestor, and something called mitochondrial DNA. So mitochondrial DNA, the mitochondria are actually bacteria that infected human cells before they were human cells, going right the way back to, you know, billions of years, got into a cell and lived there symbiotically. So basically what a mitochondria does, and it still does it now in our cells, it produces energy from sugar. So you eat sugar, that gets broken down in your body, the mitochondria in your cells turn that into energy for the cells. So the mitochondria get fed with sugar, your cell gets fed with energy. So it's an alien body inside every single one of our cells that happened billions of years ago, which in itself is fascinating. But the other fascinating thing is only the female egg has mitochondria. All the mitochondria in the sperm from your father are in the tail of the sperm. And when a sperm penetrates an egg, the tail gets broken off and lost. So you only ever get mitochondrial DNA from your mother. So by tracing mitochondrial DNA, you can take that all the way back to your original female ancestor. And interestingly, if you're, they're fluffy terms, but if you're genetically European, all Europeans, genetic Europeans, I'm not talking about politics or anything else, are descended from seven particular women. So they're the only women whose mitochondria have left descendants today. How about that?
That's really interesting. So my uncle just done one of those very specific DNA tests not long ago, the one that tells you where, literally exactly where you're from around the whole of Europe. And yeah. I want to do it for myself because I want to see what my dad's side comes up, because only, so I'm literally, like you could say, let's say 50% of his DNA, because it's the same as my mother. And we've come up 80% Polish, so central, that kind of region, which also incorporates pieces of Belarus, a little bit of modern day Ukraine. But we're 80%, it's very, very high, that percentage. Then we've come up with about 9% German And they traced that to my grandmother. And I made the joke of, oh, dear God, we're not pure Polish. This is awful. How could I have German DNA? Chris is going to come up with a comment in a minute, but how could I dare have German DNA in there?
There's nothing wrong with having a little bit of German in you.
Anyway, moving on. Then it's about 11% Scandinavian. And I know that because some of my ancestors came, or one of my ancestors came from the Scandinavian region. And then it was, and that's it. And I was surprised. I was really surprised. I didn't have any Jewish in me, like nothing, zero on that side.
Yeah.
And usually from those regions, you would come maybe what, even 0.5% or nothing, zero, nada. So it's very interesting when you get that kind of breakdown of DNA of who and what you are. And I also want to know, because my question, I'm going to come to a question in a minute. Why are people so obsessed with this? I mean, it becomes pure obsession about DNA.
Yeah. A couple of points. First one is, as I said, half your ancestral DNA is thrown away in every child. So every child loses half their DNA. And it may be that the half of your DNA that was thrown away had something Jewish in it. So if you've got siblings that do the test, you can obviously you can sometimes find different results. It won't be massively different, but you can find some differences in the results because they've got probably got some DNA that you haven't got. And that's normal because when DNA is shuffled randomly, so, you know, it's in a double helix, it's peeled apart, then it's put back together and shuffled randomly. So you never know what's coming. And that's why sexual reproduction is so successful, because if you're a banana, you've got the same genes as every other banana on Earth. And if you get one disease that kills all bananas, it will kill all bananas, because a banana can never get any protection genetically against it. If you're a human being and you're alive in 1380 in the UK, you've probably survived the plague. A third to half the people didn't survive it for all different reasons, but some of it will be to do with genetics. And some of that can be traced right the way back to the Yamnaya culture in the Bronze Age that came from the steppes, probably brought the Indo-European languages with it, walked across Europe and ended up in, you know, the UK eventually, but across the whole of Europe. And as the Yamnaya culture came across, they believe now that the way they were so successful in colonizing Europe was that they had some degree of immunity to plague. And the reason is they came from the steppes where plague was endemic. And as they walked across Europe, they spread the plague to everyone they met. So the Neolithic cultures that were there before them gradually had a collapse within like 100 years, maybe, of population because they had no resistance to the plague. And this has happened several times in history. There's all sorts of interesting, I put some stuff on my blog about this. There's all sorts of interactions over history where different diseases have collapsed populations. So you not having any Jewish necessarily in you doesn't mean some of your ancestors weren't. It just means, you know, you go back five generations, you might not have any of their DNA, hardly, other than maybe mitochondrial, or not in your case, Y DNA, but if you're a man, Y DNA, you know, your Y chromosome. So it's quite possible to lose all the DNA from certain ancestors. There may be no trace of it anymore. So that's the first question. The second question is, why are people so interested in it? And about, you know, am I a Viking? Am I a Celt? Am I an Anglo-Saxon? And it's marketing. People sell it on the basis of romance. You know, what would you look like as a Viking? Have you got Viking DNA? What type of Viking DNA have you got? Are you an English Viking? Are you a Norwegian Viking? They're doing that now. And it's mainly nonsense, but it's harmless nonsense. And it's quite funny. You know, the best one is Celtic. And I always get on my high horse about this. People talk about, you know, Celts. What they generally mean is someone that speaks the Celtic language. So there were never, ever any people that ever called themselves or were ever called by their contemporaries Celts in Great Britain and Ireland. The Celts originated in parts of southern France and Spain, and the rest of it is a modern invention. Doesn't mean there wasn't a culture, doesn't mean there wasn't a language, because there obviously there was, probably brought by the Phoenicians who were trading for tin and copper with Wales, the West Country, etc., and Ireland. It was a trading language, Celtic, and it got adopted widely, like English has done. So calling people that lived in Great Britain and Ireland Celts is like saying, if you watch American films and you speak English and you eat McDonald's, then you're American. It's the same thing. So, but the same with Anglo-Saxons. You know, the Anglo-Saxons didn't exist until a few hundred years after the Anglo-Saxons, Jutes, Frisians, Franks all came across. And most of the people in the UK are descended from people from the Bronze Age, with a little bit of Neolithic and about 10% Anglo-Saxon, etc. But the companies are doing fantastic marketing. You know, they're saying, wouldn't, you know, who wants to be someone from the Bronze Age? Never heard of that. Yemnaya, what's that? What about Viking? Oh, yeah, no, I'd pay to find out about that. And good luck to them. You know, they're making money out of it. So, and it's not false. You know, you may be related to some people that were Vikings. You may be related to, you know, I don't know, someone who was Celtic, but you're probably more likely related to someone that spoke Celtic rather than someone from somewhere in the south of Spain. So that's why there's an obsession with that. But people all want a story, don't they? And that's the important thing. You know, when I was talking about tracing trees, you can have names, you can have dates, you can have places, but, you know, so what? A story. That's what captures people, and that's what we want. And that's the difference between genealogy and history. History gives you these big stories, and sometimes smaller stories, but genealogy gives you the story of the ordinary man and the ordinary man out of the Dickens novel that you're related to. And it's that personal part of it that's so important. And that's what captures people. When I do someone's tree now, I don't just trace trees anymore. I, you know, that's not the most enjoyable bit. What I do is I find their stories. So when you see me on the telly, they use me to go over the tree and find stories. And for some people, it's really easy. They jump out the page at you. Other people, it's really, really tough, and you really have to dig to try and find an interesting story. Not that they wouldn't be interesting to them, but when you're doing it on the TV, you've got 4 million people watching. You know, you want to make it interesting to everyone. But genealogy itself, that's the history side of it, if you like. But genealogy itself brings you into history and gives you a story that's unique to you, because everybody's different. And that's I think, is why, plus really great marketing by a lot of these companies.
So when you've been doing it, has there been any of the stories that have been your absolute favourite? Jump up and grab you.
Yeah, I mean, when I've done some of the celebrity ones, I mean, you can see them on the show, but, you know, there's been some very funny ones. Years ago, I started tracing. So let me tell you how I got into DNA Journey, because this is quite a funny story, and it leads into one of the stories. So I'd done me bits on Meridian, local TV. I've been on there. I've done a few, you know, announcers and people's family trees and told them what I found in that. And I've been on the radio, and I started writing articles for Mensa magazine. So I joined Mensa because I had no qualifications, just a few O-levels. So I thought, well, if I join Mensa, no one can call me thick. Even though I look like this and sound like this and I've got no qualifications, I'm a member of Mensa, so you can't call me thick. So that's what I did, and that was on my CV, and that helped get me into computing and all the rest of it. But I started writing articles for the magazine. I started looking for stories. So I started a blog site. And I thought, well, the way to get people to look at this blog site is to have famous people on here with interesting stories. So anyone that was famous had an unusual name, I'd trace their tree and see if I could find a story in it. And one that came up were the Redknapps, you know, Jamie Redknapp, Harry Redknapp, you know, and they're from London and they're Cockneys and I am. And it's like, great, I'll enjoy doing this one. So I traced their tree and wrote it up on the blog. Put it all up there, lots of interesting bits of stories in there. And I was on holiday in Tenerife with the missus, and my phone went. And I picked up my phone and I said, you know, hello. I was still kind of working then. So I still had a proper job. I was doing consultancy, business consultancy at the time. But anyway, so I answered my phone on holiday. And this bloke said, I'm a TV producer and we're doing this show. And I thought, oh, it's a scam. You're going to try and get some money out of me. I was going, yeah, whatever, you know. Then he said, we saw you had a blog and you've done a lot of work on the Redknapp family. I said, yeah, that's correct. And I thought, oh, okay, this sounds genuine. He said, well, we're making this new show called DNA Journey. He said, and we'd like, you know, to know if you'd let us use some of your research for the show. And I thought, right, you know, I've been in sales for so long. I've run companies. I'd sold companies. And I thought, right, what am I going to get out of this? So I said to him, I said, yeah, of course you can. Yeah, of course you can use it. No problem at all. Then I said, but you'll have to pay me. Went quiet. He went, yeah, we could probably do something about that. So I thought, right, okay. He said one yes. Let's see what else I can get out of him. So I said, and I want to be in it. And left the gap like that. And you could hear the tumbleweed. And he said, well, why don't you come back and see us? When you're back from holiday, come in and we'll have a chat about it. So basically, I went up to Voltage TV, great company. You know, they make all the programs that go out. And went to see them. And they could see I'm not shy. And I don't mind talking. And, you know, I knew my stuff kind of thing and on this particular subject. So I said, I'll tell you what, if you put me in the show, I'll give you another story that I've never published. Because the trouble is, as soon as you put something up on a blog, some bugger comes along and nicks it. So it ends up in the local paper, it ends up here, it ends up there, and you get nothing for it. So the really juicy stories I keep to myself because you never know when you might be able to exploit them. So I said, I've got another story about the biggest successful wages snatch in British history. They went, oh, yeah, okay. So anyway, cut a long story short, we started filming with them. I did various things. And we did Jamie Redknapp and Freddie Flintoff. And this was up in London. So we went up there and I met them in a pie and mash shop in Crisp Street Market in the East End. And I went in and had my pie and mash. And then they were due to come along. So I went out and was sort of doing a bit of research, just totting up on a few things. They go in the pie and mash shop. I walk up. They don't know who they're going to meet. They don't know what's going on. They know it's about their family history, the family tree. They don't know if they're going to meet an expert. They don't know if they're going to meet a relation. They really don't know. So when you see these people on these programs surprised, they really are because they do not know what's going to happen until it happens in front of them. And a lot of this is done in one take. We just do it. So I stroll in the pie and mash shop and I look at the board as if I'm going to order some pie and mash. They're sitting at a table. I take my coat off and say, God, it's raining cats and dogs out there and sit down. And they're like looking at me saying, who's this bloke? What's he doing? And Flintoff, he's a big bloke, you know. He leans across the table. He said, you better have something to do with this show, mate, or you've got some big balls on you. And I thought, oh, no, I'm going to get lumped by pretty Flintoff here. And, of course, then you start talking to him. And basically what I'd found is one of Jamie Redknapp's relations in 1840 was a customs man. So he'd started off as a watchman, and the watchmen all got thrown out when the Metropolitan Police came in the about 1829. And he managed to get a job as what was called a landing waiter's messenger. So he was in customs and he was transferred up to Liverpool Docks, which was fairly new at the time, getting lots and lots of trading from America. And he went up there to basically act as a messenger between the guys that were on the boats in the docks, making sure no contraband was taken off and making sure the taxes were paid, and the guys on the land who had to take the goods off the boat and make sure the right tax was paid. So you had one lot guarding the boats until they could dock, and another lot guarding the stuff when it was on land. And he was a link in between them. Great big bloke, 6 foot tall, found out all about him. And he worked up there for a little while and he's doing a good job. But while he was up there, he had his family with him as well. He worked out that the guys on the boats could be on the boat for days, even weeks at a time, waiting for the right tide to come in, waiting for the ship to be at the dock before they could unload. And while they were on the boats, they'd get bored. They'd be guarding the cargoes, basically. And they'd be gambling. They'd get women on board. They'd be drinking. And they were only paid quarterly. So these blokes never had any money. So what William Redknapp did, he found a guy that ran one of the local parishes who had a load of money because he'd been basically skimming it from building roads and running workhouses, borrowed money from him, lent it to these guys. Then when their wages came in every quarter, they would sign off what was called a chitty. He would take it to the wages office, collect their wages, give them what they, you know, what they were expecting, and keep what he was owed in interest. Then he'd pay off the money lender. So he was a middleman getting all this going, all this money going round. And it was working really, really well. And he was making a bit of money out of it. And then one day, he must have been sitting at breakfast, having his cup of tea. And he thought, right, today's the day that they get their quarterly pay. And there was 1,500 quid coming in, which was a lot of money in 1840. And he'd just been to the money lender and just taken 700 quid off of him to lend them. And instead of taking the 700 quid, taking the 1,500 quid and giving everybody what was owed, he got his family together, his wife, six kids, and according to the newspapers, an incredibly small black dog, got on a train and disappeared with just over £2,000 in his pocket. Now, £2,250 or whatever it was in 1840, roughly today is about 2 million quid. And he got clean away with it and he was never caught. So that was a brilliant story to break to someone.
That's absolutely epic.
And you can imagine the reaction. Jamie was mortified because he'd played for Liverpool. And there was his ancestor nicking all this money off of his workmates in Liverpool. And he did a call with his dad, with Harry. Harry wasn't surprised at all for some reason that his one of his, you know, his relations was nicking from the Inland Revenue. But I think he found it quite amusing. But great story. Great story.
Paul, this has been such, I mean, the time has just completely and utterly just disappeared, first of all. Second of all, I know that we've got another 10, 15, 20, 35 different stories we can talk about. So my idea of thinking here is to get you back to come and do some of these stories, because this is, we've not even hit the tip of the iceberg here. There is so much more to go. And I'm sure Chris is sitting here at the end of his seat going, I have to know more. Tell me more.
Absolutely.
So
no, it sounds brilliant. I'll have to come back.
We're going to get you back because you've even got some really interesting criminal ones, and you've got things to how to look for war records and things which may be useful for some of our listeners.
Yeah. Well, let me end it then. Yeah, the war records thing, we can do that. That would be great. Let me end it on a warning. So we talked about DNA. The thing you have to remember is people lie. Documents lie. DNA can't lie. So when I was 64, I know it's hard to believe, but when I was 64, I had a DNA test done and started putting it through Ancestry, looking at the connections and that in the tree. Loads of hits on my mother's side. No hits at all on my father's side. Loads of hits on a family side I didn't know. And I couldn't work out what was going wrong here. I thought, I haven't got the tree wrong. Something's up here. So I got one of my nephews tested, one of my brother's sons, and he came up as my half-nephew. And I looked into it, and I came to the conclusion that my dad wasn't my father. This is at 64 years old. And I phoned up my cousin, who's 80 now, so he was like 13 or whatever when I was born, and said to him, Stevie, there were any rumours about me when I was born? He was like, let me have a think about it, Paul. Anyway, 10 minutes later, the phone rings and it's his wife, Pauline. She goes, I told him, just tell him what you know. And the story came out. And basically, my dad wasn't my biological father. And my mum knew, my dad knew, everybody knew except for me. And they all died and took it to their graves. And I was the only one who didn't know until I was 64 years old. So be warned, it's a double-edged sword. You know, you may be opening Pandora's box. If your DNA says your dad isn't your dad, then your dad's not your father.
Well, this is it. This is what happens quite often. It's happened to one of my aunts, basically. She's not a blood relative in marriage, and they discovered a whole wealth of various different things happening in the family. You know, babies that were given up for adoption secretly had. I'm like, wow, okay. So let's see. I'd like to open Pandora's box. I'm interested as a historian. I'm interested, so I'd like to know a little bit more. But it would be really gut-wrenching if I found out that my grandfather, or basically my grandfathers who did amazing things during the war, not really my grandfathers. I'd be like, no.
So be warned. Yeah.
You also get fun things where your family tell you stories that turn out not to be true. Like my great great grandfather died in the Boer War, and I said to my granddad, "Well, what happened to him?" He said, "Oh, he was a Boer, and he probably got shot in the ass running away." And then it was always quite funny. Then he came back to me one day and said, "Oh, yeah, no, he was shot in the liver, and he took him 3 days to die." I was like, "Oh, right,
Ooh.
shit." And then it turned out, no, he died of typhoid. So, which, you know, is bad in itself, but it was but yeah, you get these family stories. And when I volunteer at the Engineers Museum, it's like, oh, I was told my granddad did this, this, and this, and you sort of do the research and come back, sorry.
There's
So
always
may
a
not
grain
find what
of
you're looking
truth.
for.
Like, yes, he was killed in the Boer War, but the circumstances weren't quite right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely very interesting.
Right, Paul, we're going to get you back. And you should write a book on this. Then we can
Should do, shouldn't
publicise
I?
it. Yeah.
Yeah, will do.
So, Paul, it's been great having you on. We are definitely getting you back. Thank you so much.
Been a pleasure.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.